This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning author and journalist Chris Hedges about his latest book, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt.
And graphic artist Joe Sacco described five sacrifice zones in the United States and also described their optimism of occupied Wall Street and changes that can happen.
We'll hear part two of our interview with economist Rick Wolf.
If you want to understand the LIBOR interest rate scandal and the frauds affecting every bank you might have your money in, listen.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, about a month ago, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit confirmed the 2010 decision by Federal District Court Judge John Codal to change his 28-month sentence for Lynn Stewart, our longtime friend, to a sentence of 10 years.
A longtime friend, as well as we've had her on the show a number of times. She's in prison right now. But Heidi, why don't you, we can talk about the sentence in a second, but remind our listeners who Lynn Stewart is, what happened to her, the fact that she is now in prison.
A longtime criminal defense attorney who took on progressive cases and cases essentially that had defendants that were vilified by the government. So the Sheikh Abdelrahman, who was convicted in the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center, was her client that led her to be indicted under the Bush administration with John Ashcroft going on to late night TV to announce the indictment on charges of aiding terrorism. And it essentially boiled down to the fact that a press release had issued during Stewart's representation of the so-called blind sheikh, which was a violation of a special administrative measure that she was forced to sign in order to visit her client. Noteworthy was that this happened during the Clinton administration, and Janet Reno just sort of gave a slap on the wrist and said, don't do it again.
Right. They didn't think it was serious enough to bring criminal cases under Reno. And then, of course, they used her as a poster lawyer to really intimidate progressive and radical and any kind of lawyer who took on these very unpopular, quote, Muslim terrorist cases.
And what happened was when sentencing, the original sentencing was held, hundreds of supporters of Lynn Stewart, former clients, attorneys who'd worked with her, people whose lives she'd touched, really came forth with an outpouring of positive letters. And the judge gave her what the prosecution called a very lenient sentence of essentially about 2 years in prison. And knowing also that she was in poor health, the judge weighed all these factors. But then pressure from the government came, and Codal actually added on almost 8 years, giving her a sentence of 10 years, which many say is really a life sentence given her age.
Well, the government appealed the 28-month sentence that she had originally, and the Court of Appeals sent it back for resentencing, saying, Judge, you didn't take in these factors. It's almost like the Court of Appeals said, you better give her more time. And Codal, who did something relatively courageous in giving her 28 months because the guidelines called for, I don't know, 20 years, then realized he'd had an order and he essentially gave her the 10 years. The appeal, and we had a show about the appeal here where we had her husband talk about the appeal, and the appeal was on First Amendment grounds because when Judge Codal in the lower court, the district court, sentenced her, he sentenced her in part because of the Second Circuit saying you have to do this and you didn't take in these factors. But he also used two public statements she made after her initial sentence. One was, when she came out of the court after the initial sentence, was something like 28 months.
I could do it standing on my head.
Right. And she said that was what some of her clients had told her. And I think what she said in the exhilaration of getting 28 months, which is still a severe sentence and it meant disbarment, it was still a relief because she had gone in expecting, I guess, 10 years or more. So that's that statement.
And then she made a statement on Democracy Now.
Right,
when
that's the second
statement.
She
would do it again.
And you have to go back and look at that statement. Democracy Now! Asked her, well, would you do things any differently now? And she says, well, I would do things differently, but I would still represent my client zealously and do what I felt was necessary again. So those two statements Judge Kodal used in saying she's not showing any remorse, she's not really sorry for her crime, etc. And those are additional factors for why I'm making sure that she's going to feel remorse, and gave her the 10 years. On appeal, she claimed those were protected by the First Amendment, which, of course, they are protected by the First Amendment. And the circuit court, the three judges, went back and forth on, well, yes, they're protected, but you can use characteristics of the defendant in doing sentencing, and this illustrates characteristics or character of the defendant, and therefore the judge was okay to use it. She had a very famous First Amendment lawyer argue the case, Harold Price Farringer. So her sentence of 10 years got affirmed in the circuit. And I think it's way too long. The initial trial was ridiculous. I mean, it was tried in a time of terror in this country, supposedly, when the jury went, you know, was shown pictures of bin Laden, et cetera, and she was convicted. Then she got the initial sentence and then upheld on 10 years. So now she has doing a 10-year sentence. She's in her early 70s. Hopefully, she'll get out before anything happens bad to her, so she can, you know, come out in life again and not do her whole sentence. But she also just did have an operation there, Heidi, and I understand she's doing well from that.
Yes, Lynn recently had surgery. She reports that she's doing well. She's on the road to recovery, and she feels, in her words, better and stronger every day, and continues to want to hear from her friends. So people, if you're thinking of writing, send a letter to Lynn. Lynn would love to hear from friends from around the country. To send her a letter, we'll post this on the website, but if you have a pen, it's Lynn Stewart, number 53504-054, Federal Medical Center, Carswell, Box 27137, and that's in Fort Worth, Texas, 76127. Again, that information will be on the website, but we're thinking about Lynn, wishing her the best for her recovery, and still distressed at this long sentence.
She's a good friend of ours at Law and Disorder, and a good friend to the many people she represented, it, including hundreds of people for free or very little money in the various communities that she worked in. Heidi, you're the lawyer we call the queen or the king of what to do when the cops come to try and bust you or do other things at protests around the country. I know you're going to be at the RNC, of course, in late August. You'll be at the DNC, I presume, as well.
If all goes well at the RNC.
The Guild will be there in both places. And, of course, the Guild has been on the front lines of representing protesters forever, certainly since I've been in the Guild some 40 years. OWS as well. And the Guild also gives out a lot of information, not just at the demonstrations with the observers with the green hats, which I think you designed.
Well, I partially upgraded them.
The color.
The color, the neon green.
Well, the color is like impossibly difficult to look at. Nobody else has that color. But if you see that color, you know that the Guild is there to help you negotiate with the cops or to keep the cops away. But the Guild also has some incredible materials, and I want to have you talk about that and how people can get that. I'm holding two of them, a beautiful green one and a beautiful red one. Both of those are primary colors. One is in U.S. English, and the other is in,
as opposed British English?
I would say Egyptian Arabic.
Arabic.
Arabic, just like standard Arabic.
Yeah, you're holding it the wrong way. Not just teasing.
No. Arabic, as people know, open from the left, and American English or English opens from the right. I'm holding the one that opens from the left. It's Arabic. It's beautifully done. And people can get these. And first, tell us what's in them. They're called Know Your Rights, right?
Well, it's called You Have the Right to Remain Silent, a Know Your Rights Guide for Law Enforcement Encounters. They're designed specifically to be pocket size, so they can fit in your pocket. You can carry them around to a demo if you want. And we offer them free of charge. We have them in English, Arabic. We're just coming out with one in Urdu, which they'll all be available also electronically at nlg.org. In addition to being available electronically, we have many hard copies that we're happy to send to community groups, individuals, organizations. So just go to nlg.org, and it will have information about ordering them.
It's interesting. What? Give me, for example, what the first category is in the book.
The first category is what if FBI agents or police contact me? So we have, you know, what if an agent comes to the door? Do I have to answer questions? Do I have to give my name? Can they search my home or office? The basics.
It's great. It's a short book. It fits into your pocket. It's really fabulous. So I recommend people getting it. How do they get it again?
Go to nlg.org. You can email or call us, and we'll send you out as many as you'd like.
It's free.
It's free.
Called again?
You have the right to remain silent.
Do specify whether you want it in Arabic, English, or Urdu. We now go to an interview with Pulitzer Prize-winning author and journalist Chris Hedges. His latest book, co-authored with the graphic artist Joe Sacco, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, sends a powerful message about what rampant capitalism has done to destroy America. The book is filled with graphics by Joe Sacco, illustrating some of what Chris Hedges refers to as sacrifice zones in the United States. Areas that have been torn apart in the name of greed, progress, and technological advancement. These areas include the Lakota Reservation in Pine Ridge, South Dakota, the streets of Camden, New Jersey, the coal fields and mountaintop removals taking place in Kentucky and West Virginia, and the practical slave labor that people pick our tomatoes under in Immokalee, Florida. The interview was recorded live during a WBAI fundraiser. It's a remarkable interview. Let's have a listen.
Hi, Chris. It's Michael Smith here with Michael Ratner. You know, we just love this book. Both of us read it in the last several days. We've been so enthusiastic about it. I think it's our listening audience that shares that enthusiasm. You write about how when you started out, Occupy Wall Street hadn't happened yet, and you were anticipating a revolt. But then when it happened, then you had the hope, and you write the last chapter. And I wanted to ask you, what's it going to take to get from where we are to where we want to be?
Well, first of all, I mean, one of my frustrations with people who keep plowing their hopes back into the Democratic Party and the formal structures of power is that I don't think they've taken time to examine where power lies and how power functions. And, of course, the public relations industry, which works on behalf of the corporate state, is quite good about tricking people or making people believe that the personal narratives of candidates somehow make a difference to the centers of power. So when you go through books like Sheldon Wolin's Democracy Incorporated, when you look closely at Ralph Nader, no one understands corporate power, how it works better in this country, or has been fighting it longer than Ralph. You grasp the political theater, how all of the internal levers of power have been gripped by corporations. I mean, the judiciary is largely a wholly owned subsidiary of the corporate state, and particularly the Supreme Court, the systems of information, and I've watched it over my 30 years as a journalist, have just, the walls have narrowed. What passes for political debate in this country is sort of Dorothy Parker used to say about Katharine Hepburn's emotional range as an actress, that it goes from A to B. If you challenge the approved narrative, you're out. I mean, MSNBC just spins the same court gossip from a different angle that Fox does. And so when you look at the structures of power and you grasp that what we have undergone is a corporate coup d'etat in slow motion, starting with the Reagan administration and culminating to where we are now, it is utterly impossible within this system to vote against the interests of Goldman Sachs. When you read Carl Pugliani, The Great Transformation, or go back and look at Karl Marx, you know, you can debate his solution, but his analysis of capitalism is pretty remarkable. They understand that unfettered, unregulated capitalism is a revolutionary force. It knows no limits. And it will commodify everything until it destroys it, until exhaustion or collapse, whether that is human beings, whether that is the ecosystem itself. Since it knows no limits, and since there are no more impediments built within the formal mechanisms of power to disrupt essentially corporate cannibalization, then the only thing that will impede that movement is some kind of popular unrest. So when we began the book 2 years ago, well, the title was always Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. But, of course, the revolt was conjecture. But it was an understanding of where power lies at this point, corporate power, how it works, and the fact that there were no mechanisms built in for self-restraint. And then, of course, we saw the rise of Occupy in Zuccotti Park. Revolutionary movements, and I think this is a revolutionary movement, at least the great scholar of revolutions, Crane Brinton, in Anatomy of Revolution, which I just reread, would argue, I think when you look at all the attributes that go into creating a revolution, the most important one being fundamental demand is one that the power elite can never agree to because it would mean their own dissolution. So all through the Occupy movement, people kept saying, what are your demands? What are your demands? You know, what do you want? Electoral reform. And what they fundamentally wanted was something the power elite couldn't hear. They wanted to wrest power back from the hands of a corporate oligarchic class and put it back into the hands of citizens.
Chris, I'm almost afraid to say anything because you're making such strong, amazing points. And I think that point on demands is really crucial. I mean, because they wanted demands that they could satisfy. Electoral.
Well, they want demands that will force you to put your energy back into a dead system. And the poster child for that is Wisconsin. They could have gone one of two ways. They could have gone for a general strike and kept themselves outside the structures of power, which is what they should have done. Instead, they let the Democratic Party and the AFL-CIO take them hostage, funnel them back into a dead system, work for a recall in which the deck is completely stacked against us because we don't have the money, we don't have the systems of communication, and it's going to be very hard for them to reconstitute their movement.
In Wisconsin, Obama didn't say a mumbling word. The Democratic Party did not, on a national level, support the recall. Obama didn't come in and try to help. He made one tweet the night before. So the Democrats are just as afraid of a big mobilization of people as are the Republicans.
Well, that's why the Democrats, or let's say a Democratic administration, was behind the coordinated federal effort to shut down the occupying cabinets.
Chris Hedges, who co-authored the book Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, an amazing book on what I would call five interrelated communities in the United States. I want to take you back for a second and how you began to look at those and what some of your conclusions are.
Well, these are the sacrifice zones. These are the places that went first. And we begin the book with Pine Ridge because that's where the whole demented project of endless exploitation and endless expansion and endless consumption began. And it wasn't just a matter of seizing land for the railroad magnates and the timber merchants and the gold speculators, all of which it was, of course. It was also about destroying a competing ethic. Another way that communities had formed within indigenous cultures to relate to each other and to relate to the natural world. And understanding that all life, not just human life, but life itself was sacred. And understanding that you could create communal structures within an indigenous culture. Someone who hoarded and kept things for themselves was despised. Everybody ate communally, everybody lived communally, and it's not accidental that when Marx and Engels begin their work, they make a very, very close study of the Iroquois and how the Iroquois nation, as did the Founding Fathers, by the way, how they governed themselves and how they functioned as a society.
Well, that was that book, Chris, was Ancient Society, and it was about the Iroquois up in the Catskills. And
right.
Marx and Engels said that along with Darwin's book, Morgan's book, Ancient Society, was the most important book of the 19th century because they begin it in a communist society. I'm very glad you made that point.
And Morgan, of course, lived with the Iroquois. I mean,
yes.
he knew them well. And so we begin with Pine Ridge because it's about breaking a culture, essentially replacing dignity and self-sufficiency with a culture of dependence. What that engenders is essentially this horrific despair that consumes to this day indigenous communities. So you have an estimated 80% alcoholism rate on Pine Ridge. The average life expectancy for a male on Pine Ridge is 48. That is the lowest in the Western Hemisphere outside of Haiti. And these sacrifice zones, and we go on to the coal fields of southern West Virginia, the old urban centers, Camden, New Jersey, which per capita is the poorest city in the United States, they went first, but were next. And the reason we went into these places, including Immokalee, Florida, is to show what happens when human beings and human societies are forced to kneel before the dictates of the marketplace. What is the result of that? Because we are fed this utopian ideology that somehow if we build our culture and our society around the demands of the marketplace, we'll get some kind of utopian heaven on earth. And it is an utter absurdity, an utter tautology when you walk into the places where that's happened. And the reason we went to those places is because, in the end, we didn't want a book about polemics. You can't argue with what's taken place. You can't argue with the fact that the coal companies are turning the Appalachian Mountains, which are the lungs of the Eastern Seaboard, which provide much of the headwaters of the Eastern, into a fetid, poisoned wasteland that can never be reclaimed. And, of course, Immokalee becomes emblematic of what the corporate state wants when it reconfigures both the nation and the global economy into a form of neo-feudalism. What it wants is a working class that is utterly disempowered, that has no rights, and that when it is not, I mean, these people all show up, of course, at 4 in the morning at these collection points, and when they don't get enough work for the week, they can't pay the $50 cash to the landlord to sleep with 19 other people on the bottom of a trailer, and the three trailer parks are controlled by three white families in Immokalee who fixed the prices, of course, at $2,000 a month. These trailers should have all been condemned years ago. Then they're sleeping out under mango trees. As Bernie Sanders says when he went to Immokalee, in the vast race to the bottom that has become America, Immokalee is the bottom. So we wanted to show how these forces worked, what they did to human beings, what they did to the environment, and how they're essentially within the structures of power. There are no levers we have left by which we can thwart what they are doing, that reconfiguration within the country and, of course, the global economy, where workers are told that they have to be competitive in a global marketplace, which means being competitive with sweatshop workers in Bangladesh who make 22 cents an hour, prison labor in China. That's where we're headed, and it's only through acts of civil disobedience and resistance that we have any hope of saving ourselves, and that was, of course, the beauty of the Occupy movement.
We are speaking with Chris Hedges, who, along with a wonderful graphic artist, Joe Sacco, wrote Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt.
You know, the Occupy movement, everybody is very, not everybody, but I mean all the pundits, I mean including on the left, like Alexander Coburn and others, are very quick to write off this movement. And this shows, for me, an incredible misunderstanding of how, again, revolutionary movements work. The configuration of rebellious or revolutionary movements is never determined by the oppressed. It's determined by the power elite itself. Now, if the Obama administration and the corporate state was able to respond rationally, and this is a constant theme in Paul Krugman's columns, you know, we have to respond rationally to the economic crisis. And I was on Democracy Now! A few weeks ago, and Paul was on after me, and when he finished, I said, everything you say is true. It presupposes that the systems of power have the capacity to respond rationally, because if they don't, appealing to those systems of power is a waste of time.
I think that's great.
I think that the decision to try and physically erase the Occupy encampments exposed their hand. Now, if they responded rationally to the suffering that is sweeping across the United States, and not just the poor and the working class, but increasingly, of course, the middle class. The New York Times did a piece a few weeks ago that looked at people who had lost their jobs in the middle class in 2008 and found that of those who had found employment, again, who were not long-term unemployed, almost all were working at salaries that are 40 or 50% lower without benefits or any kind of job protection. So the assault that was the violarization of the American working class is now, of course, being visited upon the middle class, those middle class managers in many cases who made it possible. So if they could respond rationally, they would declare at a minimum a moratorium on foreclosures and bank repossessions, forgiveness of student debt, Medicare for all, and a massive jobs program targeted especially at those under the age of 25. That would be a kind of New Deal response. And, of course, when Conrad Black writes his biography of Roosevelt, he says that Roosevelt's greatest achievement was that he saved capitalism. And I think that's right.
I do too.
When you have political paralysis, in essence, a governmental structure that is unable to respond to the most basic needs and injustices that are visited on a majority of the citizenry, then you not only, of course, empower extremes, and we can go the wrong way. I mean, proto-fascism, movements like the Tea Party and the Christian right are virulent and real and frightening. But it means inevitably there is a backlash outside of the traditional mechanisms of power. So we can, you know, what will come next? I've covered disintegrating movements all over the world for 20 years, the two Palestinian uprisings or intifadas, the revolutions in Eastern Europe, East Germany, Czechoslovakia, Romania, the street demonstrations that brought down Milosevic. I have absolutely zero doubt that there will be a reaction. It may not call itself Occupy. It may not look like Occupy. And Occupy was a tactic in the same way that the Freedom Rides were a tactic. But that something is coming, I am certain, because the centers of power don't have the capacity or the will to respond to this steady assault. And look at just the last few weeks. Hundreds of thousands of Americans have lost their unemployment benefits, which means tens of thousands, maybe more, people are going to lose their homes and go into bankruptcy. We saw the Supreme Court severely weaken public sector unions. We saw a refusal to adequately fund the food stamp program, and 47 million Americans depend on food stamps. That sort of steady thud of this corporate leviathan that is unstoppable keeps moving and rolling and exacting more pounds of flesh. And that inevitably means there will be a response.
When Occupy Wall Street was beginning, I remember Francis Fox Piven writing that, look, don't expect this tomorrow, but this is the beginning. And as movements or revolutions happen, they don't all happen linearly. They don't just go in a straight line from Occupy Wall Street to fundamental change. They go up and down. But in the next 10 years, whatever the number, we may see fundamental change.
Well, of course. And, you know, just as 1905 was the dress rehearsal for 1917, just as 1765 and the Stamp Act Rebellion was the dress rehearsal for 1776, this is the dress rehearsal for a major confrontation and, I hope, a defeat of the corporate state.
And Chris, it's absolutely stunning. I mean, really amazing reportage and amazing graphics with Joe. So thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much, Chris Hedges.
Yeah, thank you. Take care.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Why the Economy, Challenging Capitalism is the title of Professor Rick Wolf's new book. We've done more than a dozen interviews with Rick Wolf since 2008, and a theme emerges. Beyond the corrupt banks and stock markets is a flawed economic system. A system that, at its worst, needed to change direction in the 1970s, when wages stopped increasing and the cost of living continued to rise. As we look around, the collapse has been coming down in steps, and many have been trying to dial back, save, and prepare for it. This, as millions have already lost their jobs, 401ks, pensions, and even their homes. Overseas, the waves of austerity to continue to push through Europe, as protests have erupted again in Spain. Professor Wolf joins us to talk about his book, Occupy the Economy, and about the increasing revelations of fraud plaguing the banking world. We go now to part two of our interview with economist Rick Wolf.
And it is very strange for me to say that I am part of a consensus. I normally don't find myself there in this profession. But right now, the consensus is what Bernanke said. Things are very poor, very weak, and we really have to be alert that the situation is actually going to deteriorate over the rest of 2012 and into early 2013.
But when he says that, doesn't that have a negative effect in terms of how people respond?
Absolutely. I mean, anyone who's paying attention, which I have to tell you is a relatively small portion of the American people, given what we don't know about economics, given the way economics is not taught in this society, given the fragmentary, erratic way bits and pieces come across the news, never explained in a way that people can internalize and make use of, more and more people pay no attention. But of those who do, all the signs are negative. There's nothing to point to. There's a little bit, if you're very optimistic, you can read the housing statistics as perhaps suggesting we've hit the bottom, i.e. it can't get much worse. Even that's being questioned by a lot of statisticians, but it's one of the very few areas you can look at all, and there's nothing else. The whole world is in a problem. Nothing has changed fundamentally here.
Okay, I know that that Heidi is anxious to go into all of the massive frauds and bank shenanigans we've seen. And we can number them one through, take out a sheet of paper, number from 1 to 100, but I guess we'll number from 1 to a half a dozen today or so. But I want you to talk about that and what relation it has to the whole thing we've just been talking about. Is there a relationship, or are they just a little fraudulent?
I think we can go through quickly four major areas where the biggest banks in the world have gotten caught. I'm not going to say where we discover they're doing something, because in each of these cases, it's highly likely that they've been doing this for quite a while and that something happened to make them vulnerable to exposure. But before I do, let me answer your important question. What's the connection? I think the way to read what we're about to go through is to understand that when a capitalist economic system begins to unravel, we're in the fifth year of this crisis. It officially begins in December of 2007. That makes this year five. And by the end of this year, we will have completed five.
You know, I wouldn't have even realized that.
Exactly.
I mean,
that's an important number, because this was not supposed to happen. Right. We were supposed to have learned the lessons of the Great Depression to preclude this kind of an event. When it began to happen, we were assured, for example, by President Bush in the middle of 2008, that it was a housing crisis. It would be limited to a housing crisis, and we would quickly get through it. Nobody should worry. We've been reassured by Obama after Bush that this would be a short, we would get out of it. This would solve the problem. This is the solution. Nothing. And we are nowhere near the end of this. Well, however long it lasts, and no one knows, I can assure you, we are not at the end or anywhere near the end. And not only that, every major government program, the stimulus, the bailouts, has not achieved the goals that it said it could and would achieve. So in this situation, here's another sign. The biggest capitalist institutions in this country at this time, the banks, are in such trouble, are so worried about their own prospects in an economy in such difficulty, that what they are systematically doing is taking excessive risks, pushing the envelope of what's ethical and moral, and crossing the thin and blurry lines of legality. And when you do that, and you do it over and over again because you're desperate, because you convince yourself you might as well do this inappropriate thing, because if you don't, you won't be here, in which case, What are you holding back for? You're in a new situation. Things you wouldn't have done earlier, you got to do now. Plus, you're having a growing number of people who are willing to say, this is too much, whether that's a reporter in a newspaper, whether it's an angry employee who's going to turn whistleblower on you, or what it is, the number of people who see and are angry at what they identify as an expression of a system out of control and hurting them is growing. So
That's interesting, because I think if you look at, you know, the banks that went under in the early part of this economic depression, really, and the anger at the banks and the foreclosures, and now you're seeing what we're going to go through, a half a dozen particular frauds or crossing lines
that
are being exposed. It's almost as if people are so angry they're willing to let these exposures come out, really,
that's right,
in a way.
And then once they get out, they have a life of their own. So let's quickly go through them. First, and the one that's the biggest, because it's a planetary event, is this LIBOR, L-I-B-O-R, stands for London Interbank Offered Rate. Here's what it is. Starting in the middle 1980s, London, which had been for 200 years the financial center of the world economy, realized what we all understood at that time as economists, which is that the world economy was becoming dependent on credit in a way it had never done before. Every corporation was borrowing money all the time. Every government was borrowing money on a scale we had never seen before. And the really innovative thing was the mass development of consumer credit, not just the home mortgage, which had already existed for a few decades, but the credit card, which became a dominant phenomenon really only in the 1970s. And then the automobile that can only be bought on credit, and then the explosive of the last 10 years, student credit, the need for students to pay for their college educations by borrowing. To make a long story short, every transaction in the world, everywhere in the world, was being mediated, was being shaped by the credit conditions. So it became necessary to have a credit system, to have a system of rates. Every lender, and they're all over the place, had to figure out, what do I charge? How do we work this out? It's a technical problem, but it's also a practical problem. So a decision was made, let's have a universal benchmark, a basic definition of an interest rate that tells us what is the interest rate that the people who are the biggest lenders and the biggest borrowers and the most secure, what do they pay for borrowed money? And then all the rest of the lenders, your neighborhood bank, your local mortgage dealer, your crook on the corner, they all know that's the basic cost of money. So for my little business, I'll charge that plus a little to get something for myself. The LIBOR became the benchmark for the world. And here's how it works. Every day, the British Bankers Association polls the 16 biggest banks, who have offices in England anyway, what they are charging each other. It takes an average, and it announces that. And so they began to do this in the middle 1980s, and that number is a standard number. For example, variable rate mortgages in the United States, where the interest rate goes up and down depending on, those are based on LIBOR. So whatever the LIBOR announcement is, that's what you're going to be paying next month to your local bank for your mortgage. And it's factored into everybody's borrowing, more or less. So even if you're thinking about going into a store and buying a pair of pants, that store and the producer of the pants also borrowed money, which was also shaped by a relationship to LIBOR. What we now know is that the banks who provided this information figured out, this is not complicated by the way, that what they said gave them, in a sense, an advance idea of what the announced interest rate would be. And if they said something higher than it actually was, then they could influence what the world's interest rates were.
Because the LIBOR rate would go up.
And then everybody else's
interest rates go up.
Well. That's right. So the problem is that these biggest banks are among the biggest holders of debt instruments, derivatives of all kinds, obligations of all kinds, mortgages of all kinds. So you are relying on information given by somebody who has an active interest in the information they're supplying.
Right, because
that's called a conflict of interest.
Right. See if I understand that. They get every day the
whoever gets the LIBOR number. There's some organization. What's it called?
The British Bankers Association.
Okay, the British Bankers Association calls these 16 big banks and says, what are you guys paying for borrowing from each other and
exactly.
from other banks? If the banks who are reporting raise that number, interest rates go up, these 16 banks are holding a huge amount of people's debts. They can charge those people more money in interest for the debt they're holding. And they make more money.
And they may be holding instruments whose rate and whose worth goes up and down with movements of the interest rate. So by reporting a higher than otherwise, they can make certain kinds of investments pay better than they would have if they had told the truth. What we now know is that these banks often reported an interest rate, here's what became the scandal, different from what they were actually charging.
Where was the oversight, however?
There was no oversight. The world of super banking is a very cozy world. It's very small. It's really a group of men who all know each other, go to the same clubs, play in the same golf, come from the same universities, marry one another, have affairs with each other's secretaries, the whole business. And the people who run the British, the Bankers Association, used to be big bankers, will again be big bankers. It's that kind of revolving musical chairs kind of an arrangement.
So let's go. They reported a higher number.
Or a lower one,
or lower
whichever
number.
They felt like.
And
that... Well, we know now that it happened. See, before it was a suspicion. Because if you knew how LIBOR worked, years ago you would say to yourself, uh-oh, how do you prevent
right.
a report that is self-serving on the part of these banks? But what we now know is that it happened because Barclays, one of the biggest banks in the world, a British bank it happens to be, has admitted doing this. That is, admitted reporting a different number than was actually the case and have paid fines, now totaling $450 million to both U.S. and British authorities as a penalty. It should be clear to people that this is a tiny percentage of the profits of Barclays and will not amount, if you pardon me, to a hill of beans for them. It's a black eye in the press, but it is clear to me and to others that they paid the fine because while the money is inconsequential, being exposed as one of the biggest bankers in the world that systematically lied tells you the following. To save itself, to improve its survivability in a global crisis, this bank used its wealth and power at the expense of every transaction practically on the planet. To be blunt, they screwed everybody to save themselves, leading any reasonable person to ask the question, that kind of behavior with those kinds of consequences really make you have to question whether banking is not too big to fail or too big to be allowed. It is a failure. It is a costly failure. And really, why can and how could we defend private banking on this scale ever again? It's only one kind. The big culprits so far, and there are more than these two, but the big ones are Bank America and Wells Fargo. Both of them have now agreed to pay fines. A few months ago, Bank of America paid in excess of $300 million, and Wells Fargo last week paid a fine of $175 million. For what? They were charged by the U.S. Justice Department and a collection of states, Illinois, I forget the other ones, Baltimore were part of the plaintiffs in all of this. Here's what they were accused of and what their fine was for. They went and charged African-American and Hispanic-American families more interest for mortgages than they did for whites who had identical credit scores. In other words, they didn't do what they say they do, make a loan based on your credit worthiness, they actually added something. It meant that for those, and there are, the suit identifies over 30,000 people that have already been found who fall in this group. Those African-American and Hispanic-American families paid thousands more dollars during this crisis when everyone was on the edge than they had to. It meant that many of them had to default on their mortgages because they couldn't make these inflated payments. Their credit scores are ruined for a long time, will impede their ability to start a small business, to pay for their kids' college education. The damage done and the fine, I did the arithmetic, the fine for Wells Fargo, $175 million, as against their profits for this year of about $16.5 billion, work out to 1%. So the cost to Wells Fargo is a fine that is 1%, and they can pay it over the next couple of years, of 1 year's profits. So what is it? It's nothing for them. It will not affect their stock.
It's overt discrimination against black and Hispanic.
Absolutely.
Based on
ruining
essentially
their lives.
And what they got
race
by
and ethnicity.
Right. And what they got by this settlement was the avoidance of endless horrific publicity about what they did. And can you imagine a trial in which family after family of African-American and Hispanic descent would have gotten up there and told of the damage done to the mother and the father and the children and the friends and the neighbors and the...
We got to get you through the next
Rick,
few.
This is astonishing.
It is
it's
astonishing.
There are two more to go.
Yeah, we have two more to go. So let's go through the
we
next
have JP
two.
JP Morgan.
JP Morgan Chase, Jamie Dimon, the president of that bank. His reputation is pretty much in tatters now because he supervised traders who have apparently lost, the estimates vary, somewhere between $5 and $10 billion by taking inappropriate risk, which goes back to you know, Michael's first question, which is, in a time of crisis when these banks are on the edge, they are doing all of these things that they probably always did, but more of them, taking a bit further risk, and are getting seriously caught. The last one, HSBC, another global bank, which has just admitted in a report filed by 7-Eleven in the Senate that they have been laundering money, drug money from Mexico, Al-Qaeda operatives from Saudi Arabia. We're talking numbers in the billions of dollars. They're terribly sorry. They're going to take a lot of steps to deal with it. Senator Levin, Carl Levin, nicely put it the other day by saying, it's wonderful that you say that. We really appreciate it. But let me point out to you the number of times over the last 25 years that you have said the same thing, which is enough of a comment. There's really not more to say. So four of the biggest bank in the world, Barclays, or five, Barclays, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, HSBC, and JP Morgan Chase, have all admitted within a very short period of time major breaches of minimal ethics, minimal morality, legality, all in order to advantage themselves at the expense of an immense public. It is the greatest exposure in a short period of time of the reasons why private monster banks are an unsafe way for any society to manage the credit that has now become central to the economy.
Why does the Justice Department want to make deals with these institutions rather than have the opportunity to press criminal charges?
I asked that question 50 times over the last 10 years, and I've only gotten one plausible answer. And when I've asked them to comment on the answer, which I'm about to give you, every single person I have asked has said, that's right. And that is the only answer. And here it is. We at the Justice Department, or we at fill-in-the-blank, Attorney General of the State of Maryland, or whoever else, we do not have the staff, the resources, and the money to go after these banks because they have much greater resources than we do, many more lawyers, economists, statisticians, and accountants on staff. They can and will hang us up forever. And during that time, the political leaders we have to answer to are going to be destroyed in the press because those same banks will make sure they're portrayed as incompetent political bureaucrats who can't get anything done in the face of these banks. The banks themselves will say it, putting such a level of danger on the politicians and the bureaucrats under them that they much rather settle for $100 million and help a few people a bit than to go into a process which they think, even if they win the case, they will lose more than they will gain.
Instead of that 1% for settling, it seems to me that given the climate with public outreach, the government could be trying for a 5 or 10% of their net profits.
Right. And if they did that, which I understand they could do, two things I've been told would happen. One, the banks wouldn't settle. They'd force it into this extended process that I've just described. And number two, whatever they're giving Mr. Romney, if it's the Obama administration, now will be quadrupled. Because and not just to sway the outcome, but to let all the political players know what the cost is of not playing the game.
Well, we saw that when Jamie Dimon went to testify before the House and the Senate. Jamie Dimon, the head of J.P. Morgan Chase, who lost his $5 to $10 billion for non-oversight of his trading desks. They basically, it was like a party at someone's private mansion.
Right.
They went all over themselves for Jamie Dimon, particularly interestingly in the Democratic Senate. In the House, they were a tiny bit tougher on Jamie Dimon. The Republicans were. It seems to me that particularly on the LIBOR rate, the London Interbank
Offered rate,
which affects all of our interest rates for when we borrow from credit cards to mortgages to people who speculate on derivatives. Why aren't there just a giant billion civil suits against these banks? Everybody has either, certainly people who speculate in the interest markets have gotten just, it's completely unfair to them, whatever we think of speculators, but all of us, it's very hard to prove, these are very complex cases, to prove that my mortgage went up because of something that happened with LIBOR, up or down or lying, it's impossibly hard. But won't there be just a zillion lawsuits?
There already are. The attorney generals, last I looked, of both Connecticut and New York, I know that, are looking into suits. Pension funds that invested heavily in instruments are looking into suits. It is expected in the financial world that a mountain of suits are going to be filed. But as you say correctly, Mike, it's very, very hard to figure out. Because remember, what you're going to have to do is try to argue that there's a loss based on what something might have been had a different report. That is right. Extremely difficult.
Had they reported it accurately, and it's a day-to-day report.
That's right. So that, you know, what, and by the way, what they reported also affected the actual. So it's not as though these are two independent things that you can measure. So it'll become a game in which the two sides will have economists like me getting paid a lot, like I wish I would, to make endless arguments that will go way beyond what any jury would understand anyway, which is fine. It hangs the process out, which is in the interest of the banks and which they can do longer and better than anybody else.
We're going to give you the last word. What's the optimism? We got an economy in the world going down at best or staying bad.
Well, for those of us,
and then we have bank frauds everywhere.
For those of us who have been critical of capitalism as a system for a long time, for us, this represents sign after sign, proof after proof, evidence upon evidence that this is a system that doesn't work. It is inappropriate for us to have banks that have more money than the government supposedly regulating them. It's inappropriate to have banks in a position, whether they tell the truth or not, the lying is just extra to shape what happens to the rest of us, and we have no control. We live with the results. It violates every norm of democracy I can imagine. So as to the solution, we shouldn't have monster banks. We should break the banks up. The banks should be subject to the government control. Probably would be better if they were government agencies. They impact us a great deal more than the army, and we keep the army as a national a public state event. And finally, we ought to have mass oversight by workers in the banks, who number in the hundreds of thousands in many of these banks, and by the communities that are all impacted by this. So there's some democratic control and some democratic involvement in the numbers, so we could catch inappropriate action much earlier. And you know something? If that were done in the United States, if we actually took the leadership, it would be relatively easy to get the Europeans, the Japanese, and the others to go along with it, because it's too dangerous for any bank for this to happen in one place and not in another. That would give you an unfair competitive advantage. And the mass political support in Europe to come down on their banks is much greater than here. It'll be easy to get the political momentum around coming down on the banks in Europe compared to here. So if we actually had some leadership here, you could make these kinds of changes. You could make them uniform across the advanced world, and that would go a long way to us not being in a position of constantly vulnerable to, threatened by, and incapable of controlling something that has become central to everybody's life, namely credit.
We've been talking to Rick Wolf, who we have on the program occasionally, and his new book, Occupy the Economy,
challenging capitalism. If you haven't read Rick Wolf or listened, this book is great. Occupy the Economy, Challenging Capitalism. Rick Wolf, thank you very much.
Rick, my blood pressure goes up whenever you're on because this is such maddening stuff, but you make it so easy to understand.
Yeah, well, you should. If you're not mad, as they used to say, then you're not paying attention.
Thank you, Rick.
I can't believe this. If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.